it away, Miguel.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be talking at the Embodiment Conference. I'm going to be sharing some of my work. So I'm both someone who's personally interested in meditation, but for the last 12 years, I've also been doing various kinds of research work on this. So I'm going to share my screen now so you can see my slides. Okay, right. I hope you can see this. So just to give you a tiny bit of background, how I started my work on meditation. So this was originally a project where we were looking at the effects of both meditation and yoga in prisons. We were working with this wonderful small charity, the Prison Phoenix Trust, which for over 20 years has been organizing meditation and yoga classes across most British prisons. And this is particularly relevant to everyone interested in embodiment. So here you see some male prisoners doing some yoga poses. And quite a lot of the people, I mean, without any doubt, the majority of people that end up in prison, it's rather tragic. They just had a very difficult start to life. So the usual positive processes which allow us to learn how to communicate with others in terms of attachment and to be able to regulate our emotions and behaviors, they miss that early in life. So quite a lot of the process of doing yoga and meditation for them is getting in touch with their emotional and very basic behavior processes. So when we did this study, we learned that there are some interesting benefits for this particular population from doing yoga and meditation. So that particular work led me to write a book, a trademark book with a clinical psychologist, Can Meditation Change You? And at that time, I realized there was quite a lot of misconception and also ignorance, including my own, about how these wonderful, very creative techniques have developed across time and space and within various traditions. So for the last 5 years, I've been working with about 50 authors to put together this Oxford Handbook of Meditation, which will come out next year. So I've got a bit of stuff to share with you. And to make it easier to digest and communicate, I have structured this around five, which I think are quite straightforward questions, starting with why do we meditate down to does meditation produce a unique state of consciousness or if it can have even negative effects. So throughout this talk, I'll be giving you not just these questions, but variations on these questions. And please use the chat function to give some of your answers to this. So starting with the first one, why is it that we meditate? So one of the main reasons which we hear about why we meditate today is because quite a lot of the time in everyday life, our mind is looking a bit like this cubist jigsaw puzzle. Right? It's hazy, it's confused. So we meditate to get a whole range of benefits, whether it is physical, mental health, to increase our well-being more generally, or even thinking about increasing our compassion, empathy, up to what we may call more spiritual consequences, such as experiencing a special or unique state of mind, such as pure awareness. So the first question I have to you, and please use the chat function if you wish to, is this statement. The traditional aim of meditation has never been to achieve physical or mental well-being. This goal is a recent development of meditation in the modern world, so the last 50 or so years. Is this statement a fact or fiction? I will give you a few seconds before I continue. Right. So this is a list of the traditional meditation goals across various traditions, starting with the liberation from the cycle of death and rebirth, which we find in some East Asian traditions such as Hinduism and Buddhism, union with the divine, you find pretty much across both Western and Eastern traditions. Salvation of the soul would be more Western based in the Abrahamic religions. However, moving again back to the East, you also find goals such as the achievement of harmony or balance, the development of supernatural powers, and that of physical immortality. And the criticism, so although meditation goals have been mostly related to ideas of self-transformation that move beyond the world and also beyond the body, there has also been a smaller but significant interest in achieving physical benefits such as longevity, even immortality. And there have also been for a long time criticisms of using these techniques to achieve these physical benefits. So here, for instance, we have a Taoist text from the 4th century before Common Era, where they're criticizing some people who do these Taoist practices, mostly related to breath works, but who are mostly doing this to achieve longevity instead of seeking the kind of deeper self-transformation, which is a trademark of Taoist practices. Right, so the answer to the question is that no, it's incorrect that the emphasis on physical benefits or well-being is only happening within modern times. It's been happening for longer, although it has been marginal. Moving to the second question, for how long have humans been meditating? So we are all aware that the major world religions as we know it, from Christianity, Judaism, and Islam to Taoism, Buddhism, and Hinduism, are relatively recent developments in the religious human history. But for how long have meditation techniques been used? This is a sketch, it's still an incomplete sketch, of the varieties of meditation techniques. Just to give you a sort of taste of the creativity of these techniques across various traditions. So at the very top, you have what we call the therapeutic tradition, which is the one which has been developed in the last 50 to 100 years. So things like mindfulness-based interventions, transcendental meditation, or physical relaxation. And I'll say something more about that later. Moving towards the bottom, the roots of the tree, we have on the right-hand side the Hindu tradition with things like pranayama, which of course you're all familiar with, so mostly breath-focused exercises. But we also have the arisal of the yoga traditions. So yoga, not in terms of physical postures, because the origins of yoga have to do with very static postures. So for instance, in the Ekagrata, it basically refers to the focus on a single point, single-mindedness focus. And then you have other traditions such as Kula visualization, where you have the sort of meditation on the chakras. And I mean, again, giving you something closer to us within Christianity, you have things like prayer of the heart, so recitation of a simple prayer, which is again very common across most traditions. Something more unusual, the divine light contemplation from the Eastern Orthodox tradition, where you're meditating on the insight of the light of God. So all the way up to the Taoist tradition, which is very, very sophisticated, and it's probably the least well known in the West, which has what we generally call apophatic practices. Again, similar to to yoga, the original yoga, very focused meditation, starting with breath work, but with the aim of emptying the mind, down to more imaginative, visualized practices, such as inner cultivation, also called, of Naidan, also called inner alchemy, where you're focused on energy circuits. So you're moving the chi along the body using various meridians, which are also known from traditional Chinese medicine. So it's a very, very rich tradition that we're talking about. And I just showed you this so that we can sort of move away from this overemphasis only on mindfulness-based techniques. So there's a much, much wider variety which engages not just our imagination, but our senses, our breath, and also our emotions and singing. So for instance, in the Islamic tradition, but also in the Hindu, there's quite a lot of things involving chanting and meditating on live music. Right, so the second question is, there is historical evidence that meditation techniques have been used for at least 15,000 years. Is this fact or fiction? So those who feel like it, please answer in the chat function. Right, so there is no clear answer to this. Although we know, we can say that there is no clear historical evidence that meditation practices are older than 3,000-4,000 years old. So the earliest written records we have from within the Indian scriptures, in which there are some vague references to meditation techniques and people on the margins of society using unusual techniques for self-transformation, aren't older than 1,500 before Common Era. So is there a connection between these practices and earlier shamanic ecstatic practices, in which the trademark of these practices was really long singing and dancing sessions, which led to some kind of ecstasy? There are some similarities, but overall there's also quite a lot of differences. So even when I've talked to anthropologists who specialize in indigenous cultures, they overall say that it's very hard to come up with meditation, static meditation techniques, which are used individually, meaning separate from the larger community. However, on the other hand, the kind of experiences that are recorded with the meditation techniques have some similarities with the states of consciousness that are described in these shamanic ecstatic practices. So although we do not have recorded evidence that these practices are longer than, say, 3,000-4,000 years, there are, on the other hand, some continuities with earlier spiritual practices. So moving to the third question, is meditation different from physical relaxation? I thought that given that so many of you are interested in embodiment, it would be interesting to explore this question, which is a very neglected question within the meditation science literature. But it's very relevant, as you will see. Now, let me start by telling you that this year we are celebrating the first 50 years of meditation science. So before this, there were some scattered studies, but it was really with transcendental meditation, first publication of papers in 1970, that a large science of meditation really kicks off. Excuse me. Now, and it's interesting to note that these first papers on the science of meditation were very much focused, not on mental health, but on the physiological effect. So what is this technique doing to one's body and metabolism? And again, Transcendental Meditation, which sponsored the first set of meditation studies before mindfulness studies kick in about 20 years later. Again, they're mostly focused on things like hypertension, stress, insomnia, asthma, so all sorts of physiological changes. And only then they moved on to more mental things, such as personality and intelligence. Now, I want to move us a bit further back. Some of you may be familiar with Jacobson's relaxation techniques. These are still used in many forms of psychotherapy, including cognitive behavioral therapy. So this is his best-selling book from 1934, with the title You Must Relax, and the subtitle Practical Methods for Reducing the Tensions of Modern Living. Think that this was published about 20 years before the word stress started being used as we use it today. So if it had been published 20 years later, it would have had stress, reducing stress of modern living. This basically shows that we've been concerned with trying to find embodied techniques that help us deal with the problems of modern life, modern urban industrial life, for longer than we are usually aware of. So early in the 20th century, there were movements in the Western world which sort of combine physical exercises with breathing exercise and were usually enveloped in some spiritual framework, although some of this was not mainstream spirituality, mostly esoteric. So what Jacobson did was get hold of some of these techniques, which had both Western and Eastern influences, and take out the spiritual part, make it much more secular and focused on one's body. And these relaxation techniques were used from the 1930s onwards across the Western world. Most notably, another bestseller from Herbert Benson, a medical researcher at Harvard. And look at this wonderful image of women who are given preparation classes for giving birth using precisely physical relaxation techniques. This was taken from a photograph in England in the 1950s. And of course, here's one of the founding fathers of cognitive behavioral therapy saying that he recommends meditation very much like he recommends Jacobson's relaxation method, not as a therapy in itself, but as something that might help therapy. So here you start to see that some major figures are thinking of the use of relaxation methods alongside those of meditation. So my third question is, in his best-selling book, The Relaxation Response, Herbert Benson explained that the positive effects that meditation and relaxation techniques achieved were identical or the same. Is this fact or fiction? Please write your responses in the chat if you feel like it. So, this is actually a fact. Herbert Benson said that the effects were practically identical of either doing meditation or physical relaxation, that they achieved the same positive effects. Now, there is a long discussion, and this is an ongoing discussion within the science meditation literature about the similarities and differences. To what an extent are meditation techniques doing something different from relaxation? Now, note that many meditation techniques start by a similar relaxation process in terms of introspective awareness, so of quieting down, focusing on one's body, usually starting with a focused breathing exercise. And in many meditation studies where they have active control groups, they're using relaxation techniques precisely to see how different is it to meditate from doing physical relaxation. And the results are very mixed. In many studies, the benefits are indeed identical, as Benson is saying. In other studies, there are differences where meditation or relaxation may work better. Now, moving on to question four, does meditation produce a unique state of consciousness, such as, for instance, pure awareness? Now, this is a complex question. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Professor Kabat-Zinn, who's also taking part in the Embodiment Conference. This is a relatively recent quote of his, in which he says that, just so it is clear what I mean when I use the word mindfulness, and he's saying this because people use mindfulness in different ways. So he says, I am using this as a synonym for awareness or pure awareness. So he's speaking of mindfulness as a very particular and special state of consciousness, potentially unique. And the idea of meditation leading to a unique state of consciousness is also present in the origins of the science of meditation, when Transcendental Meditation published its first set of papers, in which seemed to show that this technique led to a unique state of consciousness, which was different on various physiological measures, both from a wakeful state, from being asleep, or from being in an altered state, such as being hypnotized. So there are claims along the last 50 years of the science of meditation that these techniques may lead to a unique state. Now let me try to sort of deconstruct or give you the larger context for this. So mindfulness, you may have heard, comes from Pali, the word sati, which originally comes from smriti in Sanskrit. And what it really means, it means simply to remember or to recollect. And probably in the origins of Buddhism, this was associated with practices of visualization and chanting of the figure of Buddha. So it's only more recently, in the 1950s, that a book which became a bestseller by a German Buddhist monk popularized this term sati, or that we call mindfulness, as bare attention. And what this book was trying to do was to portray a particular meditation technique of mindfulness as more scientific. And this bare attention has been retranslated as pure awareness by Kabat-Zinn. So originally, within the Buddhist tradition, it doesn't mean pure awareness. It's something substantially different. Right, okay, but that's in the history of the concept. Let's focus a bit on the science. So for instance, when you look at fMRI studies, brain imaging studies of meditation, can we say that the neural correlates of meditation are unique? So there's now quite a lot of studies done on meditation and the brain. And the most significant finding from these studies, if you look at the top, not where you have the various kinds of meditation, so focused attention, in which you're focusing your attention in an object, for instance, open monitoring would be mindfulness techniques. Mantra recitation would be focusing your mind on a mantra, on a word like transcendental meditation. Or loving kindness or compassion meditation, where you're focusing your attention on very positive feelings. So the major finding from these studies is that you have different neural correlates depending on the kind of meditation technique you are using. And this is not that surprising if you think about it, because these techniques are using different forms of sensory processing. So if you're either repeating a sentence in your head, or if you're focusing on a visual point, or you're focusing on emotions, this naturally recruits different parts of the brain which have to do with sensory perception, emotion. No, excuse me. There is, however, a commonality in, so if you look at the bottom part, the left and right hand side, there's activations in the middle and anterior insula. And this is a region, so most of these techniques seem to recruit this kind of area of the brain. This area of the brain, the insula in general, is known to be associated with introceptive awareness. That means awareness of inner bodily processes, such as being aware of my breathing or of my heart rate. And again, this makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, we all know that when we meditate, when we do breath work, That's the first thing that we do. We become aware of our process of breathing, of our physiological processes. But on the other hand, we cannot find a unique set of neural recruitment. Now, what about the mind? Can meditation benefit our mental health in a unique way? Now, as you know, there's now thousands of studies looking at meditation and mental health benefits. And there's also a set of meta-analyses which bring together quite a lot of these studies and see what the overall effects are. Now, the best, most rigorous meta-analysis came up in 2014. And what it found out is that the results also vary broadly. So although there is a moderate evidence, meaning it's not strong, but it's more than weak. So there is some robustness to these results, that mindfulness meditation programs help improve things like anxiety, depression, and pain. However, there's no effect, or there's insufficient evidence that there is any effect on things like attention, which is somewhat counterintuitive because so much of these techniques have to do with attention. But it also doesn't seem to help things like substance use, eating habits, sleep, and weight. Now, I mean, some of you may be therapists or work with meditation. And again, think that these are statistical results across dozens of studies. It doesn't mean that they do not help some individuals. It just means that when you put together all these hundreds of individuals, that overall the effect doesn't seem to be there statistically. It doesn't mean that it might not help other individuals. This meta-analysis also found that these meditation techniques, even when they were helpful, they were not better than other active treatments, such as doing exercise, or again, another form of embodied treatment, or other forms of behavioral therapy. Right, so to end this section, I have another statement here, which I will ask whether this is fact or fiction. Many philosophical and religious traditions teach that happiness is to be found by living in the moment, and practitioners are trained to resist mind wandering and to be here now. And this was published 10 years ago in the journal Science. Okay, so write your answers if you feel like it. I think you will realize that this is a somewhat tricky question after all the information I've given you now. So originally, mindfulness meditation in its Buddhist traditional form wasn't so focused on the here and now. This is just a more recent development. So this statement is actually mostly false. Most religious traditions are certainly not interested in the here and now in this sense. They're actually more interested in using meditation techniques to move beyond the present, actually to move beyond space and time. That's what most of these techniques are really aiming for. Although in terms of process, I mean, part of the process has to do with being present, but that's just the process of moving beyond the here and now. So this is a false statement, mostly. Right. Now, to a somewhat, this is my last question, then we'll have time for Q&A, which I'm looking forward to. Now, this is a somewhat counterintuitive and sensitive question. And I'll tell you a bit also of the background of how I came across this matter. Can meditation have negative effects? And here I'm doing this the other way around. So I'm starting with a question straight away. So use the chat function, those of you who wish to use it. Oh, then the statement is, over 40 years ago, the American Psychiatric Association recommended that research into meditation had to consider its usefulness as well as its dangers. Is this a fact or fiction? And I will give you the answer to that straight away. So this is actually a fact. This is a position statement on meditation from the American Psychiatric Association, written over 40 years ago. So the association recommends that research should be undertaken in the form of well-controlled studies to evaluate the specific usefulness indications, but also contraindications and dangers of meditation techniques. This was somewhat surprising to me when I first found it. But as I looked over the literature, it's not just in terms of mental health that meditation techniques have been used in a somewhat negative way. So there is now recorded historical evidence that meditation techniques, Zen Buddhist meditation techniques particularly, were used by the Japanese military during Second World War, mostly to depersonalized soldiers. So to sort of lead them into a state of consciousness in which they don't care about their individual selves, that they just comply with their orders, and so that they're willing to sacrifice themselves, including committing suicide for the sake of the war. And the context for this was seen as a sacred war for the Japanese at the time. So meditation techniques have been used for what we would generally consider negative purposes. Now, what most people, including most of my colleagues, experimental psychologists who do research on this, they are unaware of, and I've learned this from people who do the history of meditation techniques, and I'm very grateful for them, is that there are early accounts of potential negative consequences of these techniques going back to the 5th century. So for over 1,500 years, there's been recorded scriptures which say that if meditation is not carried out properly, it can lead to negative consequences. So the mind can become restless, confused, unstable, and the individual become confused, dull, and sunken. And there's also accounts from other religious traditions about potential dangers. So within the Christian tradition, you're probably aware of the idea of the dark night of the soul, from St. John of the Cross. Within the Islamic tradition, there's also some references to a yo-yo syndrome, which has to do when you experience some of the bliss of meditation exercises, but then you come out of it and you have difficulty in integrating what you have experienced with everyday life. Now, there's different ways of approaching this. So for instance, the dark night of the soul is understood not ultimately as a negative experience, but as a purging of the negative sides of oneself to be able to become more purified. However, most of these traditions do consider that you can get stuck. So it's not a linear progress, and it's not that meditation inevitably leads to something positive. It can be done in such a way that it leads to negative consequences. And I would like to acknowledge here a student who has taken a Buddhist name, Damcho Pamo. She was the first person who alerted me to these potential downsides of meditation. She was, for a long time, she had been for 20 years, a yoga and meditation teacher. And one day, in a weekend meditation retreat, she had a massive mental health event. So she had an acute psychotic episode, and this was followed by severe long-term depression and psychosis, for which she had to be treated with drugs for over 10 years. Until she emerged on the other side, she went back to doing meditation, but a different kind of meditation from what she was doing then, which allowed her to ground herself. And she has, in the last couple of years, been developing this website about meditating in safety, raising awareness of mental health issues in relation to meditation practice, which I recommend to everyone. There's interesting resources. There's also quite a lot of stories of people who had been meditating for a long time before something unusual and difficult happened to them. The other reason for which I think it is important to raise this matter is that these are silent voices. When people are within a meditation class or retreat and they start feeling more anxious or even having a panic attack, or more rarely an acute psychotic episode. Usually the teachers don't know how to deal with this, and very often they tend to tell people to just keep on meditating and this will go away. And what this leads to is a stigmatization of this person who thinks that there must be something wrong with me because everyone else seems to be enjoying this. And it doesn't have to be so. Right now, the research tells us that this kind of event can happen to people who have had no past mental health history. Although it does also happen to people who have experienced mental health problems, or who have repressed traumatic memories. Now, another question is, how common are these events? And my lab has recently published this paper, which reviews almost 50 years of the literature on adverse events in meditation. And overall, they found that the total prevalence of these adverse events was of some 8%. Now, what I need to highlight is that this seems like a high prevalence. So it's not 1%, it's 8%. So it's more common than we might imagine. But there's a wide variety of effects. Most people just feel an increase in their anxiety, for instance. But the most important thing to highlight is that this prevalence is actually very similar to that reported for psychotherapy practices. So when you do psychotherapy, you can also suffer some adverse effects. About 5 to 10% of individuals suffer some difficulty or challenge or negative effect while doing psychotherapy. So actually, given that many people are using meditation for mental health and well-being purposes, this actually is mirroring the larger literature on psychotherapy. And just to give you an idea of the most common types of meditation adverse events, these mostly have to do with increases in anxiety, depression, or stress, or physical tension. And this may look counterintuitive, but within the physical relaxation literature, you also find some of these effects. So although you're trying to relax physically, some people become more tense for reasons which we mostly still do not know about. Now, I'd like to finish this section by highlighting the bright side or the light side within this dark side of meditation. So psychoanalysts like Carl Jung have highlighted how important it is to acknowledge our shadow side. If we do not acknowledge the most difficult aspects of ourselves, our aggression, for instance, our anger, whatever is lurking in the dark, that we can't really think of achieving wholeness if we don't also somehow are able to embrace and integrate that with the other aspects of ourselves. The other thing which I find is important about this literature on the negative effects of meditation is that it's telling us that a particular kind of the model, which is very, well, it's very dear to some of my colleagues who are psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, is probably wrong. So I call this the gym mind model, which is that psychotherapy or mindfulness techniques are good for your mind, like going to the gym is good for your body. They help your mind develop fitness and resilience. And I think this is giving a sort of muscular idea of our minds, and it's probably a wrong idea, because this gym mind of the model doesn't really explain how these negative events can occur by doing meditation. And of course, by doing meditation, we are getting in touch with something which lies deeper within ourselves, which we're usually not aware of. So perhaps it's now time to explore other models of the mind. And you are, of course, familiar with the Freudian idea of our mind being a bit like an iceberg, in which our conscious mind is just a tiny fragment of this iceberg, most of it lying under the surface. But You're also familiar with some of the richness of the models of the mind from these meditative traditions, which have been mostly neglected in our way of doing science. So think, for instance, of the very sophisticated Taoist model, which integrates both mind and body. So they actually do not have the fragmented understanding that we have of mind and body. So when they're looking at the circulation of qi for allowing ourselves to transform us, it's a much more integrated system, as it is, for instance, that of tantra practices within Hindu tantra schools, which has, again, a very sophisticated understanding of the different kinds of energy centers within our mind-body schema. And again, why shouldn't we try to find ways of exploring these also complex and much more integrated, wholesome models of who might be? Perhaps if we did, this would allow us to understand why these negative consequences are happening. So are we there yet? This is a kind of a cartoon of the hippie family on their trip to the Nirvana. And we have the teenager, somewhat anxious. So are we there yet? So I think all of you who practice meditation and breath work know that this is not a linear process. I think it's somewhat more similar. It somehow resembles the development of a young child, in which, you know how children are? So one day they barely speak a word, and then the following day they can speak three or four words or a whole sentence. So it's not necessarily a linear progress, and sometimes you may even fall backwards. But we are almost at the end of our talk. If you'd like to find out more about some of my work, The Buddha Pill is available as an audiobook, I think, for free right now. There are some chapters of the Oxford Handbook of Meditation. I particularly recommend the ones on the historical traditions, which are really mind-blowing, the kind of sophistication and details which we know barely anything about. And if so, some of those chapters are already online. And there's also quite a lot of materials, both academic and in terms of popular science, at my website, miguelfarias.co.uk. Thank you very much for listening. I'm very much looking forward to your questions now. Let me try to stop the share screen.
Yeah, while you stop the share, thank you so much. I'll read you some questions, if that's okay.
That's okay.
Okay, great. So the first question, great questions, everyone. I feel there is a difference between meditation and mindfulness meditation. The former is more for spiritual pursuit, and the latter is the be here now kind of meditation. Am I right to say that mindfulness meditation is safe or much safer than the traditional meditation for religious spiritual pursuit?
So there is no straight answer to that for one reason. There's very, very few studies comparing traditional kinds of spiritual meditation with these therapeutic types of meditation. However, there is something which might be true about that statement, in which the therapeutic mindfulness may be safer, only in the sense that it's much more limited in terms of the depth of altered states of consciousness that is stimulating. Because the traditional meditation techniques aim for stronger states of mind to arise, only in that sense. But on the other hand, I mean, we know that some of these adverse events are happening with people that are just trying out, say, a meditation app. So basically, we do not have the evidence to say that is the case.
Okay, great. Thank you. Great questions. Next one, regarding effectiveness studies, maybe current scientific methods are too limited to grasp how meditation works and what are the effects?
Yeah, I would actually agree with that. So we are working with the methods we have, and it's not just the methods. So we have quite sophisticated ways of, say, tracking our heart rate variability. We can find, sophisticated things, what's happening in terms of hormone release, for instance, what's the blood flow in the brain. But we are limited also by our theory, how we understand, as I was saying, how we understand how the mind works. So in that sense, we are very constrained by our model of the mind. Mm-hmm. If we had a different model of the mind, we'd be able to explore these techniques in different ways.
Great, thank you. You spoke about the training of the mental muscle metaphor, probably not being right. How about the way we create new neural pathways against the negativity bias of the brain by appreciating the positive, savoring, etc., mindful techniques that focus on cultivating seeing the positive and gratitude?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I have to say that within the meditation and spiritual traditions, there has sometimes been a use of this idea that you're doing something to yourself. It's a kind of training. And think that quite a lot of these techniques were developed by people who were quite extreme. I mean, they didn't just do this stuff. They fasted. They sort of pushed themselves physically. I mean, in the Christian tradition, for instance, there were people living on top of a pillar, I mean, for months. So really pushing themselves, because there was that awareness, that experience that if you did something particular to your body, and again, same thing like hiding yourself, putting yourself in a cave away from the light and other people, that by shifting your body and your environment, that this would eventually lead to positive changes. So there has been that awareness for a while, but sort of transposing those exercises to a mind model, it's giving a poorer idea of who we are and how we function, really.
Great, thank you. I think we have time for maybe one or two more. How do you think this relates to embodiment as we are understanding it with this conference? The mind and body not being separate at all, similar to some of the other philosophies described. Do you think embodiment is on the right track?
Oh, yes. And I forgot to mention that within the list of negative or adverse effects of some of these meditation practices, you get a lot of physical symptoms, which sometimes are not appraised in a negative way, such as you have very strong physical tremors. And some people within the spiritual traditions see this as a kind of the body processing deep negative emotions. So when you look at meditation carefully within the spiritual traditions, you really see how the body and the mind come together. I mean, really, really sharply, much more than within our Western scientific tradition.
Wow, great, thank you. And one more, I think, maybe one more. Is it true, or can you explain how you can get delusional at times when you see images and hear things in your meditation?
Now, that's a very, very interesting question. So here is where having a rich spiritual tradition. So all of these spiritual traditions, they have various commonalities. One of them is that they don't take these experiences for granted. So there is a way of interpreting what is happening, right? And we've lost that by leaving the traditions behind. We've left that. So within our medical psychological model, you can only say that is what I'm seeing real. And if this somehow makes your everyday life difficult, then you have to put it aside, right? It's only if you have the kind of larger spiritual framework that it allows you to actually say that, is this something inherently truthful or not? And there is very sophisticated answers within the various traditions to that.
Okay, wonderful. And one more, we have one more. Given that meditation can help people with anxiety and depression, how can we identify which practices to offer to which people to minimize the likelihood of negative effects? And relatedly, are different types of meditation more appropriate for people with different forms of neurodiversity or with mental health conditions such as anxiety or depression?
Yeah, again, a very, very interesting a question which has different answers. So I think the first thing is that if we are aware that meditation practices don't work for everyone in the same way, that's the first thing to actually be on the safe side and to acknowledge that some people may react badly to something which is really, really helpful for other person. We are just in the same way that an aspirin doesn't work for everyone. Some people are allergic to aspirin. So we have to be aware that one meditation technique does not work for everyone. So starting with that, then we have to be aware of the nuances. I mean, for instance, there's people that while meditating, they remember traumatic experiences that they had completely forgotten, usually in early childhood. And there are now people who are trained within psychotherapy to deal with these difficulties. I have some colleagues at Brown University, Willoughby Britton, who are specializing in this. And she now has lots of people coming to her who have had difficulties with meditation practices. Thank you so much. Yes. I really, really enjoyed. Just to say that if you have any other questions which you'd like, please email me. You can see my email on my website. I'd love to keep this dialogue going.
Yes, thank you so much for that fascinating inquiry into the history, science, and development of meditation and the awareness of safety and inviting in a more integrative model. We can continue this conversation if you like also on the private Facebook group created for this channel. You can find it in the chat. You can find the links and also on Facebook TEC Meditation and Breathwork channel. Everybody is also invited to the next session with Dunya McPherson and Dance Meditation. And also the entire embodiment conference library is available for purchase. If you are a hardcore embodiment geek like me, you may be tempted to force feed yourself with all these yummy sessions in a short amount of time. But just remember that you can purchase the library for yourself as a resource to digest in your own time. And it is also an incredible thank you to all of us and an incredible gift to the world, as your purchase allows all of these live sessions to be free and accessible to everybody else. And we'll wrap it up with one more question to Miguel. What is your top tip to stay embodied?
Breathing, being aware of your breathing. That's, I always say, that's the most effective way. If you just stop and are aware that you're breathing.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Can I just ask you, how do you get to the Facebook page?
Oh, to the Facebook page. So I think we could put it in the chat here.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, we'll put it in the chat. Oh, I see. There's the main group, and there's also coffee break rooms.
Oh, nice.
And here is from the channel sponsor. Yep, all the links are there.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was wonderful. Thank you, everyone, for joining. Looking forward to more learning together.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you so much. Bye.